Hello and welcome back, one and all, to Super Thursday. As Joe Biden predicted, it has now come to pass. I'm John Adirola, we got a full show for you. In just a little bit, Tommy Viator of the PodSafe Network is gonna be joining us to break down some of the big news of the day. You might have seen a candidate dropped out today. We're gonna be talking about that, the possible implications of it. Later on the show, Ryan Grimm of the Washington Bureau Chief for The Intercept is gonna be joining us. He has some predictions, or I guess it should be an analysis of what are the things that doomed Elizabeth Warren's candidacy. I mean, she came in, many people thought she was perhaps one of the most qualified candidates in the race. At one point was leading in the popular vote in the Democratic primary. So we're gonna do a bit of a postmortem there with Ryan Grimm. We'll be closing out the show with news from around the world and meanwhile, including a bit of good news in the world of international pandemics. We do have some good news, we will be getting to that. We will not be starting off with good news though, because we're gonna be talking about the coronavirus and Donald Trump. Two topics that make each other worse. So let's jump right into that. Donald Trump's buffoonery can occasionally be sort of funny. But when the topic is public health, when the topic is readiness for a disease that is starting to spread more inside the United States, him just saying what he wants to believe can actually get people killed. And I think that we have an example of that today. So he was on the radio with Sean Hannity yesterday, and they were talking about the death rate for coronavirus, and here is what he had to say.
Report today, the global death rate at 3.4%, and a report that the Olympics could be delayed. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think the 3.4% is really a false number. Now, this is just my hunch. And then when you do have a death, like you've had in the state of Washington, like you had one in California, I believe you had one in New York, you know, all of a sudden it seems like 3 or 4%, which is a very high number, as opposed to a fraction of 1%. But again, they don't know about the easy cases, because the easy cases don't go to the hospital. They don't report to doctors or the hospital in many cases. So I think that that number is very high. I think the number, personally, I would say the number is way under 1%. Now,
This is hunch. We have tens of thousands of cases. Doctors around the world are saying, here's what we believe the fatality rate is. And Dr. Trump believes, no, I don't think it's that. I think it's less. Why? It's my hunch. And also, I want you to believe that it's not as bad, because I'm worried that this is gonna hurt me. So even if I'm going to misinform you, even if I'm going to lull you into a potentially false sense of security, it benefits me, so I'm going to do it. And by the way, him saying they don't know about the easy cases, like, he is trying to explain that doctors, in trying to describe the fatality rate of a disease, they don't understand what they're talking about. They're not counting the easy ones. Look, we may not know exactly what the fatality rate is. And certainly, I would say the overall fatality rate is potentially less important than the fatality rate for different demographic groups, because that can be wildly different, as in the case of coronavirus. But I want to reassure Donald Trump, they do consider the easy cases, okay? They are doing that. And he says it's much less than 1%. I mean, let's talk about just America. So first of all, before we get to this misinformation, he referenced a death in New York. There hasn't been a coronavirus death in New York yet. There might be, unfortunately, more people are contracting it in New York, but that hasn't actually happened. There wasn't one death in Washington. There have been multiple deaths in Washington. The president literally does not know who is getting or who is dying from coronavirus inside of the United States. He's still obsessed with that initial 15 infections. That's the last fact he will absorb about this international incident. He doesn't know where the disease is spreading. He doesn't know who it's actually killing. He doesn't know anything, and he's not inclined to learn. But for the cases we have so far, of the 157 cases as of this morning that have been confirmed in the US, there's a death rate of 7% actually. But the lack of adequate testing by the CDC means that the number of infections is likely much higher than officially reported. So we honestly don't know, partially because of misinformation that's causing people to not get tested when they should. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But also, as you've probably seen, many people who would like to be tested can't be tested because we don't have the kit. kits. They haven't been prepared, they haven't been sent around, and people are being given the go around by their insurance companies when they're saying, I think that I might have this and I want to be tested. The companies aren't interested in that. They don't want to pay for it. It is another way that our current system of healthcare and health insurance providing is potentially exacerbating this illness. It's not less than 1%, and the death rate is not up to Donald Trump. But again, this fits in with what he's been doing for the last week or so, which is, I don't care what's actually going on with this disease. I'm worried that you being scared could hurt me in my reelection bid, and so I'm gonna tell you whatever I think benefits me. And again, it's not like resistance libs aren't taking their coronavirus cues from Donald Trump. They're not the ones that are gonna be misinformed. Only the people who trust Donald Trump are gonna be misinformed. The people who trust Sean Hannity, the people who would be watching that interview. He's misinforming his own base and potentially increasing the chance that they might die. But that is gonna become even more apparent in this next clip. Take a look at his read on what you should do if you think you might have the coronavirus.
To do this, because a lot of people will have this and it's very mild. They'll get better very rapidly. They don't even see a doctor. They don't even call a doctor. You never hear about those people. So you can't put them down in the category of the overall population in terms of this corona flu or virus. So you just can't do that. So if, you know, we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that get better just by, you know, sitting around and even going to work. Some of them go to work, but they get better.
This isn't a game. Like, that's both addressed at Trump, that this disease, this situation we have is not a game. But for the people who either did think or still think that, like, hey, you have buffoon as president, what's the worst that could happen? I don't know, let's find out. Let's find out what the worst that could happen when you have a president who every word was more ignorant and more dangerous than the last in what he just said. So he appears to think that there's a possibility that right now there are thousands or tens or hundreds of thousands of people in America that have the coronavirus and are just getting better, and that is acceptable that we wouldn't know that they have it, and that that's a fine thing. And in fact, he should get credit somehow because that means that the death rate is lower. He also said that you can just get better. So honestly, all this stuff you're hearing about the fact that it's killing people, that hey, China just passed 3,000 deaths actually, over 80,000 infections, 3,000 deaths. That sounds scary, but don't be scared because all around you, people are just sitting at home getting better from the coronavirus. There are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people that are just getting better because at the end of the day, it's just the corona flu or virus or whatever. He doesn't know. And again, he's not inclined to find out. He even said there, so you don't apparently need to get tested. You don't apparently need to get treated. You'll just get better. And in fact, you can just keep going to work. Just go to work and you'll be fine. It's not gonna kill you. You're gonna be okay. Again, that's what he is telling his own base, his own supporters. Say, you shouldn't be worried about coronavirus. You probably don't need to get tested. And even if you get infected, you're gonna be fine. Go about your day. What's the worst that could happen? I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. That's what he's telling people. And he's telling people that as literally all other branches of the US government are trying to tell people the exact opposite. Here's just a quick shot from cdc.gov of their advice for people who are infected with COVID-19. They're saying, stay home, get medical care, separate yourself from other people and animals, even inside of your own home, let alone not going to public events, going to fun gatherings, going to work and all that. They specifically say in the middle there, do not go to work, school, or public areas. Avoid using public transportation, ride sharing, or taxis. And Trump is saying, if not, you'll be fine to do it. He's saying, you will probably be okay, so let's not worry about it. Now, he's attempting to rewrite that interview, tweeting this morning, I never said people that are feeling sick should go to work. This is just more fake news and misinformation. But he just said, all around you, thousands of people are doing that and they're gonna be fine. And when you combine that with the fact that both he and Fox News has been telling their viewers for years, if not decades, you shouldn't trust anyone out there. in the media, academics, all of them, they're all liars. They're all trying to convince you of things that are not true. Trust us, they're going to take his word as gospel. And so there is a possibility that some MAGA hat wearing people are gonna come down with coronavirus and think, I'm strong. Trump said tough people don't die to this. So what, am I gonna miss work? I need the money, clearly, because things are getting better for me economically. Trump hasn't done anything to benefit me. So you know what, I'm just gonna go about my work and I'll be just fine. And here's the thing, again, the death rate appears to be between 2 and 3.5%, but that is over the population at large. That means that yes, you probably will be okay if you're an otherwise healthy person. You should still be tested, you should still certainly be treated, and you damn sure shouldn't go to work while you've got it, especially because that death rate is not constant for everyone. For people who might have some sort of immunocompromised condition, if they're older, if they have some sort of health condition, it can be above 10 or 15%. And I got news for Trump. When people go to work, when they go to public gatherings, they're not necessarily surrounded by the toughest people in the world. So sure, maybe they'll be okay, but they could spread it to people, or spread it to people who will then spread it to people who will not be okay. Those people might die because of the lies that Donald Trump is telling his base about coronavirus. And again, this is just a reminder that when you have a person who is actively anti-science, who believes that propaganda is more important than objective reality, it can have a serious, serious impact, a life and death impact on people. And we're seeing the beginnings of that. I hope that we dodge the bullet. But if we do, it will be despite the best efforts of Donald Trump and his administration, not because of it. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
And then there were two, with the announcement this morning that Elizabeth Warren is suspending her campaign to be the Democratic nominee for the presidency. How is this gonna shake up the race? Joining us now to discuss, Tommy Viator, co-host of Pod Save America and the founder of Crooked Media. Welcome to the show.
Hey, John.
Glad to have you here. You came on a good day. We were gonna talk about what Elizabeth Warren's next steps might be. Well, we now know at least one of them. She's dropped out. What are your thoughts?
I mean, look, I think that this was a decision made out of necessity. She did not really have a path forward. When you look at the delegate count that Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden have amassed so far, there just wasn't a path. I think that Elizabeth Warren has gone from being, you know, just known as a brilliant professor to being one of the most potent messengers in the Democratic Party, one of the best policy wonks, and the person on a debate stage that you want to mess with the least. So I think she comes out of this having done an enormous amount of good for herself, for her stature, for the party. I hope she is, a key part of the general election campaign. I don't know who she'll endorse. I don't want to pretend to tell her who I think she should endorse. I hope she takes some time and figures it out. But she ran a hell of a campaign.
Well, and we should say that at least the indication this morning is that she does not plan to immediately endorse anyone.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's so,
right. I mean, look, obviously she's aligned with Bernie on a lot of policy issues. I do think it would make a lot of sense in a lot of ways for her to support Bernie because he does have the more progressive agenda. But, you know, who knows how this will shake out.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I want to look back just a little bit on what she was able to accomplish. And I think one of the biggest things, actually, we don't have to go back very far. A lot of people are crediting her today as one of the most important things she did was remove what is, at least in from my point of view, the worst case scenario in this primary, which was a Michael Bloomberg nomination. And if anyone deserves the credit for knocking him out, it feels like Elizabeth Warren is probably that person.
Yeah, she dismembered him on live TV. It was like a scene from Dexter. It was the most brutal debate takedown I've ever seen in my life. she wiped out $650 million worth of advertising value in a couple hours. So yeah, pretty impressive.
Yeah, and so I did want to do a little bit of a preview of, we don't know exactly where the endorsement is going to come down, if it does come down, but we can start to try to speculate as to what effect this might have on some of the electoral math going forward. And so to the control room, I'm going to jump ahead. The most recent poll I saw of who Warren supporter's second choice was, this is by Morning Consult earlier today. Sanders is the second choice of 43%, Biden of 36%. And so, I mean, that is effectively, in this sort of thing where these sorts of polls are always going to be a little bit wishy-washy, that seems like kind of a wash right there.
Yeah, it's kind of a wash. I mean, I think what I've seen in some of the exits is that a lot of Warren supporters were white, college educated. I think they skewed women. And I think that that's a demographic profile that, you're right, probably breaks both ways. Late deciders have broken towards Biden recently. I think a lot of people who have been so anxious and worried about politics that they were kind of viewing this like punditry have broken towards Biden. So I imagine he could get a considerable number of the Warren supporters. I just don't think it's clean. There's a lot of people were talking about like there's a progressive lane and a moderate lane and Bernie and Warren are in the progressive lane. I don't think that really reflects the complexity of how voters view this choice.
Well, and I would say it's fairly obvious on social media that a lot of former supporters of Elizabeth Warren, not necessarily first choice supporters of Elizabeth Warren, feel like she has done quite a bit to try to not appeal to that progressive lane necessarily in some of the moves that she's made rhetorically and in terms of her policy. So I'm curious from your point of view, not in terms of who she'll endorse, but from her own point of view, what do you think her path forward is at this point? Does she stay, regardless if it ends up being Biden or if it ends up being Bernie, does she stay in the Senate to be a Senate ally to one of those two if they become president? Does she try to get some sort of position in the administration? How is that potentially influencing her calculation of who or when to endorse?
It's a good question. I mean, look, I have no insider knowledge into what she wants to do. The challenge that people should understand, though, is that right now Massachusetts has a Republican governor. So if Warren exits that job and takes an administration job or takes the VP slot or what have you, then Charlie Baker gets to nominate his choice, presumably a Republican, in that seat for a while. And that's probably something that everybody involved wants to avoid. Obviously, Warren has put together, you know, some of the most comprehensive policy papers on every single issue. I imagine she'll be involved as a surrogate and the messenger on the campaign. I mean, I do think that she is going to be one of the most popular people in the party. And whether Biden or Bernie wins, she's going to be someone who we will all look to try to bring both sides together and make sure that we win the general election. So I don't know how to predict. I bet she doesn't even know at this point, but I do think she'll be a big part of the general election.
Yeah, and I would just say, look, I hope that she is looking for advice from the right people, because my view, as again, I endorse Bernie Sanders, but some of the moves that she made in the last 6 months in this primary have been hard to understand, and they don't appear to have done her much good in the primary. So I worry about some of the advice that she's been getting recently, but I guess we'll see. We might have to wait a month or two to find out. So
might have to wait.
Why don't we turn to the other side of this primary? Bernie Sanders obviously did not have the Super Tuesday that he was looking to have. And in the wake of that, some of his most high profile supporters are starting to sketch out a possible path forward. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently said in an interview with Newsweek, we're in a very new phase of this race. Now is the time for us to really double down on coalition building, positivity expansion, and focusing on the vision that Senator Sanders has for this country. And so right now, in terms of the delegates, they're very close. It's like 10% gap between Bernie and Biden, and that might change, you know, with California taking absolutely forever to come in. From Bernie Sanders' point of view, if you had any advice for his campaign, do you think that this is a time for staying consistent to the way he's been campaigning, perhaps hoping that Joe Biden will, you know, have some gaffes and things like that? Or is this a time where you think he might have to evolve or change his strategy significantly?
I mean, look, I think anytime you're losing, you have to evolve. You have to try to grow your coalition. I mean, I think what AOC tweeted was exactly right. You know, coalitions are built through addition. So you have to think about ways to reach African-American voters, to reach college-educated voters, older voters, and late deciders who are worried. I mean, I'm hopeful that this campaign has moved past the Iowa-New Hampshire period where it was just like electability obsession all the time. That's all we talked about. And I think Bernie Sanders' great strength is consistency and authenticity and a clear progressive platform. I do think he has to find a way to sort of reach people on an emotional level. Like, people can mock Biden for saying he wants to heal the country or bring people together. But when you look at exit polls, that's something that comes up over and over again in terms of what people want to see. So I think people need to, you know, there's going to be a lot of voters who are really learning about Bernie, as crazy as it sounds, for the first time in their lives. And he needs to appeal to them on a human level and with a policy platform and try to bring people in.
You know, we don't unfortunately have much time on this, but looking to Biden for just a second, obviously Bernie has to worry about what Bernie does, but he's also, like, now it's down to basically two. I know Gabbard is technically still in the race, but the next debate is going to be very, very different than all the debates we've seen. If it's just those two on the stage, Biden has, I think his best debates have been the most recent ones, to his credit, but he has had some bad moments. He's recently had a few statements, like, you know, involving the arrest in South Africa, that have been hard to understand as an outsider why you would make claims like that. Do you think that there's a possibility that the thing that shakes up this race might be more of a focus from the voters and the media on Joe Biden?
Absolutely. I mean, look, this has happened over and over again in this primary, right? Elizabeth Warren took a lead and there was more scrutiny and her numbers went down. Mayor Pete took a lead. There's more scrutiny. His numbers came down. Biden has had a great couple of weeks, but I would be the first to tell you and have said repeatedly that I thought his campaign leading into Iowa and New Hampshire was very bad. And so the biggest X factor, I think, is Biden's own performance. And when you add on top of that, the increased scrutiny that comes with being the front runner, I mean, he is now, you know, it's now could be seen as his race to lose. And, you know, that's a more challenging position. I would rather not have the increased scrutiny. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, we will certainly be watching. I can't wait for that next debate on March 15th. Tommy, if you stick around, we got one more block. We want to talk about Donald Trump giving a little bit of a preview of his general election strategy if Biden is the nominee after this. Donald Trump was impeached because of his desire to have an insurance policy in case Joe Biden was the Democratic nominee, the entire Ukraine thing. Well, after that impeachment, and now that it's looking like Joe Biden might have a good chance of being the nominee, what does Donald Trump think the race will be about? Ukraine. He said recently to Sean Hannity, that will be a major issue in the campaign. I will bring that up all the time because I don't see any way out. I don't believe they'll be able to answer those questions. Tommy Viator joins us once again. So it's happening. Are you surprised that the fact that he was impeached is not a deterrent to Donald Trump bringing up this whole messy thing?
No, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, no matter who wins, Donald Trump is going to run a dishonest, relentlessly negative campaign based on attacks that are dishonest and that are just, you know, pumped through Facebook. Yeah. In some ways, this line of attack worries me the least. I mean, it's been pretty well vetted through the media. It's going to feel like old news to a lot of people. There's a pretty easy rejoinder for Joe Biden in terms of what he did right in the situation. And if Donald Trump wants to go after Hunter Biden, certainly there's some fodder there. But Donald Trump's kids are corrupt, in some cases, scumbags. So I'm not sure that's a path I'd want to pursue too deeply either if I'm the Trump campaign.
You know, so there's a few things I find very interesting about that. So obviously I agree. I think that the Trump family is incredibly corrupt in a very obvious and easy to demonstrate way. But the thing about Trump seems to be that the hypocrisy matters less regarding him than it has for virtually any politician of our lives. So do you think that, is he going to feel dissuaded trying to cast the Biden family as corrupt because of the possibility that the finger could point back at him? Or do you think he's going to feel safe from that sort of comparison?
No, I don't think he'll be dissuaded. I think he will do and say whatever he thinks will help him win the election. My issue is whether voters will actually believe it. I could be wrong. I very likely will be because that happens often. But I think like it's harder to paint Joe Biden as corrupt probably than it was Hillary Clinton, because Hillary Clinton faced 30 years of relentless attacks on her and demonization. And you could log on to Facebook at any time and see some aunts of yours posting about her literal kill list, right? It's just sort of a different situation than 2016. And so, yes, I'm worried about literally everything in this campaign. There are parts of Joe Biden's performance that keep me up at night. There are parts of Bernie's record that keep me up at night. But the Burisma stuff is not my most acute concern, just because we've kind of been through the ringer on this one and not a lot has come out yet that's actually damaging for Joe Biden.
Quick prediction, will there be a lock him up chant at a Trump rally in the next month?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Probably.
But it might be about Jeff Sessions.
Exactly. That's a good point, actually. So let's go to one other way that this issue might be raised. Obviously, Donald Trump is just going to be bringing it up. You can guarantee Sean Hannity is going to age himself years over the next 6 months by talking about it at the top of his lungs. But he's not the only one. Trump's remarks came the same day that Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee Chairman Ron Johnson told reporters he would likely release an interim report on his committee's investigation of Hunter Biden's dealings with Burisma within the next 1 to 2 months. Johnson said the timing of the investigation had nothing to do with the election, but that if he were a Democratic primary voter, he would, quote, want these questions satisfactorily answered before I cast my final vote. It is a weird coincidence, though, isn't it, Tommy?
Yeah, it is a weird coincidence. I mean, Ron Johnson is one of the most famously stupid people in the U.S. Senate. So, you know, good for him for being able to string a sentence together. What I'd like to see if Joe Biden is the nominee is one of the House Oversight Committees on the Democratic side start an investigation into Eric Trump, Donald Trump Jr. Let's see what Ivanka's been up to. Let's check out how Jared Kushner just managed to flip some company he started with his brother from 5 to 25 million. We need to play this game as hard and as brutally as they do, and it needs to start right now.
You know what I would love as sort of a silver lining of this whole thing is I would like some sort of package of either regulations, legislation that to the same extent that there have been a few attempts to try to crack down on former lawmakers lobbying and, you know, like profiting off of their positions. There should be more oversight of what family members are getting out of the political connections of the people they're related to. And I think that, look, I'm more worried about the Ukraine thing as a potential electoral issue than it seems like you are. But if Joe Biden were to roll out, you know, some sort of definitive ironclad policy that he signs on to that Trump obviously would not, maybe that would be something to reassure voters that Biden takes this seriously in a way that Trump is obviously being sort of like hypocritical about.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And look, you're right. I mean, there started some ethics and lobbying reforms in 2006 and then again in 2009, but there needs to be much more. We need to do much more to get money out of politics. I mean, that in part is why we need to win this election so desperately. We need to pass a voter access bill that makes it easier for people to vote by mail or, you know, just get to the polls generally so that voter suppression isn't killing the Democratic Party cycle after cycle. So I'm totally with you there. It's just, you know, on the hierarchy of things that give me anxiety, Ukraine isn't quite as high as a few other things.
You know, just because you brought up the possible voter reforms, obviously I, like many people, I'm sure you were frustrated by, again, on Super Tuesday in Texas, in California, incredibly long lines, some people having to wait 2, 3, even up to 7 hours to vote. Now, a lot of that is of course determined by the states, and you know, Texas is dominated by Republicans that clearly don't want people to vote. But I am frustrated by the Democratic Party's lack of prioritizing reforms to make our democracy one in actuality as well as in name. I was frustrated that, you know, Obama, back when they had the supermajority, that there wasn't a big proactive move to, you know, give us like an electoral holiday, give us, you know, these sorts of moves that would help to get out in front of some of the voter suppression of the Republican Party. Do you think that the time has come for the Democratic Party to prioritize that a lot more?
Yes. Yes. And Pelosi has passed a bill. The House has passed a bill that would do exactly that. I mean, I think about that period in 2009 that you just referenced, and the things we could have or should have jammed through. And one of them should have been a big voter access bill. It's really easy for me to say that in hindsight. I mean, the global economy was collapsing and, you know, things were falling apart all around us. And frankly, a lot of the problems we're seeing now are the result of the Roberts-led Supreme Court gutting a provision of the Voting Rights Act that would have prevented states like Texas from closing 750 polling locations in majority Black and Latino neighborhoods. I mean, that is very purposeful voter suppression. It happens in Wisconsin. It's been happening in Georgia. Republicans are doing this as their way of clinging to power as white males, like myself, become a shrinking part of the voting population. But yes, I was as frustrated as you were that California seemed to just kind of screw some things up. And I think we need to figure out what happened there.
Yeah. Well, Tommy, we always appreciate you joining the show. Everyone check out Pod Save America. You probably already have, but continue to. And Tommy, thank you once again.
Thank you for letting Anil Leb on. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Ryan Grimm is gonna join us. We're gonna break down a little bit of what went wrong with Elizabeth Warren's campaign after this. Senator Elizabeth Warren has suspended her campaign to be the Democratic nominee for president. But we can't forget that at one point, she was actually leading in national polls, briefly eclipsing Joe Biden after receiving quite a bit of positive media attention. So where did it all go wrong? Where did the fall actually happen? And joining us to break this down and more, Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief for The Intercept. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Glad to have you here. So look, I find the topic interesting no matter what, but I thought you had a great tweet earlier today where you highlighted what you found to be sort of three of the things that were particularly bad for Elizabeth Warren. So I wanted to talk about those with you. With the first being, you had some quotes from Pete Buttigieg about her lack of ability to explain how she was going to finance programs like Medicare for All. And that is, I think, popularly that whole brouhaha is pointed to as one of the worst episodes for her. So give me your thoughts on that.
Right, so this was the mid-October debate, which is kind of the high point of her race. You know, she kind of surged to the top in mid to late September, got through that first debate as a front runner fairly unscathed, but it was that second one as a front runner where everybody really came after her. And the blow that landed the hardest was Pete Buttigieg saying, you know, Senator, it's a simple yes or no question. Are you going to raise taxes on the middle class? You have a plan for everything, but you don't have a plan for this. It's quite conspicuous. And because she had built this brand of over the last 6 months, having a plan for everything, I have a plan for that. It was a devastating blow. It led to her coming out in the next few days with, you know, in the next week or so with a plan to pay for it, which then was followed by a transition plan. Everybody focuses on those latter two things as the thing that messed her up. But I think, you know, the pile on that happened at that debate was pretty brutal for her. And if you remember, shortly after the debate ended, and this is the second thing that I highlighted in my post, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez endorsed Bernie Sanders. And so this was, several weeks after he had been, left for dead, literally and figuratively. And here he comes out of the Las Vegas hospital, kind of surging back. And so those two things combined, her beginning to fall and his rise really starts to hurt him. And then the third thing I highlighted was this November 4th New York Times Siena poll that came out. Elizabeth Warren, by having such a highly educated base, was really reliant on kind of New York Times readers. You live by the New York Times, you die by the New York Times. And they put out a poll November 4th that had her losing to Donald Trump in one of the three Rust Belt battleground states and tied with him in the others, while Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders were beating Trump in all three. And so for a lot of New York Times readers whose only priority was, let's beat Donald Trump, that was the beginning of the end for her. That, okay, well, we love Elizabeth Warren, but if she can't beat Donald Trump, according to the New York Times, which they revere above all others, then they went looking elsewhere. And that's when you start seeing Pete Buttigieg and in particular start to eat into her lead.
Yeah, and look, there's obviously been a lot of talk about electability through the course of this Democratic primary. My memory of 2016 has blurred a little bit, and obviously that was a different sort of race. I don't know if that's always such a big concern, but it feels like while everyone got hit at one point or another with, is this the person that can beat Donald Trump, it feels like she was hit the hardest. And I wonder, is there anything that she could have done about that? I mean, she can't, snap her fingers and change poll results. But if you have to convince people that you can beat him, how could she have gone about doing that?
So you probably couldn't completely get away from that problem. But the way that you convince people that you can win is by winning or by showing strong polling numbers. So the key decision that's going to be looked at in her campaign was not to go on air in Iowa in particular in September and October when she was the front runner, and that was not a question of resources. She had the ability to go up and start blanketing Iowa with television ads, but she decided not to. Her advisors believed that ads like that only give you a sugar high, that studies show that 6 weeks later, nobody remembers a single thing they saw in the ad, and all of the advantage that you got from that spending dissipates. And so they were aiming everything towards caucus day, a big field office, and then a big spend in January leading to the caucus. But what that failed to understand is that even though you're not voting in September and October, what people tell pollsters matters in the material world, because there's this dynamic interplay between voters' perception of your viability and electability and what the polls are showing. Yeah. It's kind of a chicken or an egg thing. And so if you can artificially prop up your polling, through this period where you're getting absolutely slaughtered, and then you come out on the other end still in the top tier, you can say, look, New York Times said I wasn't electable, but look, I just went through a month of fire, and here I am still number one in Iowa. She decided not to do that, and so her poll numbers dove, and that has its own dynamic effect. If your poll numbers are diving and people are saying that you're not electable, then those things feed each other as kind of reaffirming each other.
So I want to give a hypothetical to you. So I agree with all three of those incidents that you pointed out. I think that they obviously did hurt her. One thing that she definitely could not have changed, but in theory, if Bernie Sanders had not run, if he had decided to forego it, if instead perhaps he had supported Elizabeth Warren, like if he hadn't been there and Elizabeth Warren hadn't had to sort of try to carve out this very narrow lane for herself where she's differentiating herself from Sanders, but trying to appeal to some of the centrists too. Like if he hadn't been there, where do you think we'd be following Super Tuesday? Would she be the front runner right now?
Yeah, that is an interesting hypothetical, and it's actually the scenario that she envisioned when she got into the race at the end of 2018. She believed that Sanders was going to look at the numbers and decide that he was going to go off a statesman. He changed the party. He ran an incredible campaign in 2016. Her campaign often talks about Bernie Sanders having a ceiling. That's not just talk from them. Like they they fundamentally believe that. You know, whether or not it's true, we'll find out in the rest of this campaign. But it's something that they genuinely believe. And so they thought, okay, well, Bernie probably knows he's got some ceiling. He's not going to run. And I think to answer your question, sure, she's a much more formidable opponent, you know, in that scenario. Because if through that September and October, or through that November doldrum, where she's pushed down, you know, into the teens, if she's also picking up the 10 or 20% that were backing Sanders around that time, all of a sudden she's back to 30, 35, and she's ahead of Joe Biden. A win in Iowa pushes her to, you know, into New Hampshire, and then with, you know, kind of if Sanders actually is rallying to her and helping her to organize in Nevada, you know, it could be a different scenario, because she's more competitive with Joe Biden in these suburbs that were so decisive on Super Tuesday. You know, the educated, wealthier Democratic voters who swung so wildly to Joe Biden, yeah, you know, do have some affinity for her as well. They just have had more on Super Tuesday. So yeah, I think you make a very interesting point. You know, people will be doing what ifs forever, and that's an interesting one.
Yeah. Well, thank you for engaging with it, Ryan Grimm. As always, thank you for joining us. You look like you're certainly busy today, so I hope we didn't take you off your schedule too much. But we always appreciate you joining the show.
No problem. Happy to do it.
Thank you. Okay, we're gonna take one last break here, but we're gonna close out the show with some international news. Meanwhile, Lynn, after this. And now news from around the world. It's Meanwhile, Lynn. Meanwhile, in the Amazon, indeed in rainforests around the world, they're getting close to being tapped out in a very important area. For the last 3 decades, the amount of carbon absorbed by the world's intact tropical forests has fallen. They're now taking up a third less carbon than they did just back in the 1990s, owing to the impacts of higher temperatures, droughts, and deforestation. And so this is important because whether we acknowledge it or not, these forests, like the oceans, are absorbing excess heat and carbon in a way that is not necessarily sustainable, even in the midterm. The uptake of carbon from the atmosphere by tropical forests peaked back in the 1990s when about 46 billion tons were removed from the air, equivalent to about 17% of carbon dioxide emissions from human activities. By the last decade, that amount had sunk to about 25 billion tons, or just 6% of global emissions. And here is the thing. At a certain point, when they are tapped out and can no longer absorb more, combined with the fact that we are burning them down, they can go from a sink that is helping us to fight climate change to an active contributor to it. And that date is not unforeseeable. The typical tropical forest may become a carbon source by the 2060s. And remember, many of these sorts of like long-term plans by people that say they're taking climate change seriously, those are plans where it's like, hey, we'll be carbon neutral by 2050, maybe, unless maybe there's delays. We're getting to that point where we're gonna be hitting some of these big effects. And so here's what I want to talk about. These are feedback mechanisms that we have to concern ourselves with when it comes to climate change. Things where nonlinear processes start to become incredibly impactful on our ability to fight the climate crisis. So at some point, the tropical forests get tapped out. We hadn't even necessarily known about them that long ago, but they're gonna be tapped out. At some point, the ability of the ocean to absorb excess heat, that is going to be tapped out. And that is gonna provide an acceleration of the impact worldwide as things continue to heat up. But those are not the only ones. We don't have much time, we can't go super in depth. But for instance, did you know that the Arctic has locked in the permafrost tons of methane, an incredible amount, as well as a number of other things that as the world heats, that will then be released, again, accelerating climate change. Forest fires, for instance, forest fires are becoming more intense and more common as a result of climate change. They are themselves also contributing to it. Again, this is an accelerating component of climate change. Desertification, like more generally. But then there's also things like, did you know that the melting of Arctic ice leaves more of the sea uncovered? And as it's darker than the reflective ice that it's replacing, it absorbs more heat, thus leading to more melting. So look, there are many, many of those, and I'm hardly the expert to explain them in the detail that they deserve. But you do need to understand that a lot of the people that are just now starting to sort of accept what's happening with climate change don't necessarily understand that this is not a constant, slowly advancing process that we can take time to come to grips with. And we have a lot of time to plan out exactly how we're going to deal with it. Some of these things are already accelerating. Some of them we might not even be aware of. And so again, the onus is on us to do what needs to be done, not eventually, but as soon as possible before some of these feedback mechanisms make the problem unsolvable. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go to the next country, but I will say in short, the Congo, for the first time in the most recent outbreak of Ebola, their last patient who was being treated for it has been released. And so this, it's not the worst Ebola outbreak that they've had, but it has been very deadly. Thousands have died. They might have moved past it. And in a time where the world is very worried about coronavirus, that comes as very good news. We don't know for sure, but right now does look very positive. Okay, with that, thank you everybody for joining me on the show today. We've got one more episode. Brett Ehrlich is gonna be joining me tomorrow. We'll be giving you our picks for garbage people of the week, as well as the 10 things that are worst about politics. So we're gonna have a little bit of fun to close out the week, me and Brett Ehrlich. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.